Okay, welcome. I'm Eric Berghoff. I'm the director of the Institute of Global Affairs. I'm very grateful for you to, on a beautiful night like this, and on the fourth day of Ramadan, to come here. This is a joint event with the Firuzlaldi Center for Africa, and it's a true delight to introduce Jibril Fall to you. He is a visiting professor in practice at the Institute of Global Affairs, and Jibril is a true global leader on migration. He brings a unique perspective as someone who has been involved in private sector activities, as a social entrepreneur, as someone engaging diaspora, and someone now deeply involved supporting the government in his native Gambia. So it's no doubt that he is also a very sought-after speaker and in these international fora. He has spoken on numerous meetings. He had he was part of the UN summit on migration, refugees and migrants. He spoke at the I have to get all the dates right now. So he spoke in the so that's the UN summit in 2016. He spoke at the high level dialogue on international migration and development. He's also been a key person in the Global Forum of Migration and Development, which was the creation of someone who had also been a professor in practice here at IDA, Peter Sutherland, who unfortunately passed away last year. But Jibril has very much taken on to push that agenda forward at the Global Forum for Migration and Development. And now, of course, another process that Peter was very important for was the Global Compact on Migration and the Global Compact on Refugees. And Jibril is very much involved as a key player in this very important global process. So he probably will have a chance to say something about that. But Jibril is also a serial social entrepreneur. He has started a number of organizations himself. He supports a lot of young people who are trying to start various social enterprises. He's done this since the early 90s. He has particularly sought to engage the diaspora. He's been part of forming a number of organizations, Adept and Afford. He, as I said, grew up in Gambia, but he has for many decades been involved in mobilizing the Gambian diaspora. He is a close advisor to his current government in his home country. He has been advising numerous governments and international organizations over the years. He also serves as the co-chair of BOND, the UK organization for NGOs involved in international development. So it's a true honor for us to have Jibril here tonight, and we very much look forward to your talk. So we will...
Sorry.
Yeah? You left something in the computer. Okay. But we will have questions and answers. We will do it very informally. We are not a huge group, so we'll... but Jibril, you wanted maybe to speak from here, or do you want to...
Okay, thank you very much, Eric, and good evening, everyone. The title of my talk is Over-Principled and Underperforming. So you would forgive me, I'm exaggerating to make a point. And in many cases, there are a number of flippant points I make deliberately. As we speak, there is the third or fourth round of negotiations, of intergovernmental negotiations at the United Nations headquarters on what's called the Global Compact for Safe, Orderly, and Regular Migration. This is the first time the world is attempting to sort out a global governance on migration. Because every country in the world has its own mechanism for managing migration. There are groupings of countries that have their own regional approach to migration. But those of us in the United Kingdom and what's happening with Brexit and how it's been influenced by migration and concerns about migration just shows that this is an area that is so contested and so difficult that multilateralism is extremely difficult to achieve. So that's one line of my discussion today. That is migration as a topic in the context of multilateralism and the difficulties faced. The second strand of argument is on multilateralism itself. This is the framework where more than two countries get together, usually in tens or possibly hundreds, or in some cases, all the countries of the world, to agree a framework for the management and dispensation of a particular topic. So all of the great agreements that we've heard about are within the framework of multilateralism. Even the international institutions, all of them emerge from that. But there is a crisis facing multilateralism. One in that in the post-Cold War period, or as some would say it, in the period of the Cold Peace, as we are in, multilateralism is challenged by the strident unilateralism of some of the strongest countries, United States, and in more recent time, Russia. Perhaps the most strident form of unilateralism is invading another country and taking it over. And that's happened recently. Another strand to the challenge is where you have multilateral agreements, whereby all of these problems have been overcome and countries have agreed to work within a global governance framework. My biggest concern is that almost the totem is to count the number of countries that have agreed to sign, rather than whether they would implement it or not. And this is the bit about the lack of performance that worries me, that we are over-principled in that we have these beautifully crafted documents. When they are read out, you know, the hair on your skin would stand up in terms of the emotional power and the way they move us in terms of what good humankind should do. Yet, when you look at to what extent it's been implemented, it is woefully inadequate. So what's causing this, and how do we deal with these difficulties, with this problem? As I said, as we speak, you have the negotiations on global compact for safe, orderly, and regular migration. This is an elaboration of target 10.7 of the Sustainable Development Goals, which talks about safe, orderly, and well-managed migration. But during the negotiations of the SDGs, by the way, the SDGs is the global framework for sustainable development for the next 15 years up to 2030. So those negotiations are supposed to set the general framework on every domain of migration. So people like myself who work in and out at the United Nations but do not belong there, we're thinking that having got the SDGs, perhaps that's okay. We can leave the negotiations of global agreements there and spend all our time and our effort on implementation. But no, in Europe, there was in 2015, there were movements of refugees and migrants from the Middle East and from Africa. And many countries in Europe thought that it was a migration crisis. I'm not sure whether it was a crisis. It was quite a number of people, but significantly smaller than the numbers that have been to Turkey or to Uganda or to Kenya. But anyway, since it was in the borders of Europe, Central Europe moving towards Western Europe, it was a crisis. I think in the UK we even thought that it was a crisis. One time I was in Geneva and people were saying, oh, the United Kingdom, you are not even accepting many of these refugees. So why are you still talking about migration crisis in the UK? I said, it is a migration crisis in the UK because you've got 20 people trying to get into our country. That is a crisis for us. It has to be single-digit numbers. Don't they know about that? So every country has a different approach as to what constitutes a crisis. But that, in 2015, is the only reason we had the negotiation for what ended being called the New York Declaration in 2016 at the UN Summit, and then you had the start of this negotiation. It was at the UN Summit that I first used the phrase that we are over principled and underperforming. And I said that I did not agree with the negotiations for this global compact because the effort that is spent, the arguments that are had, the time that is spent, and the energy, in my view, there's a big question mark as to whether it's worth it. And even if one thought it was worth it, you have to check the opportunity cost. The opportunity cost is, what about if you spent all of that time focusing on the bits that we agree on and start implementing it? Secondly, isn't it more eloquent to do and implement what you believe in and for that to speak for itself rather than negotiating and bargaining in the corridors of the UN building in New York? My sense is doing is better than talking. But also there's another moral hazard that goes with it, as we are experiencing right now in New York. Almost everything that you agree on, when you open a new negotiation, it's up for grabs. Even the things that you thought were totally sealed, signed, and delivered, they will reopen it. This is why nobody wants to revisit the 1951 Convention on Refugees, because if it's opened up, you would have countries that says refugees should not be protected. So my argument was, then why do you want to have a new negotiations intergovernmental on migration governance? Why don't you, those of the countries that want to do the right thing, just use the New York Declaration and just get on with implementing it? Nobody has given me reasoning that's convincing to me. So there must be other factors that are at play for what to me seem to be unreasonable to take hold upon all nations and amongst the smartest people who live and work at the UN building in New York. And that's what I'm trying to understand and to see whether we can make a break on this. Eric mentioned Sir Peter Sutherland, who was a visiting professor in practice here at IGA. He was my kind of Irish uncle. He was a grumpy old man. Every 3 months or so, I'll go to his offices at Goldman Sachs, and he would rant on me for 15 minutes about all of things that are going wrong. And then we'll work out a little bit of plan as to how he would usually go onto the forum and play the angry, this is what we must do, and we have a little strategy where I would come with the reasonable explanation. So we surely miss him, and he was really a tour de force, very, very powerful champion of migrants all over the world. Now, he, in one of his reports, talked about mini multilateralism, which is different from regional multilateralism. Regional multilateralism would be like EU as a bloc, what they do, what they agree in general. He was talking about mini multilateralism, where things are still within the global forum, but those who want to play would have the room to do things better. So in my paper, I picked up on that as well, just to understand these three, four problems we have and what way we may get ourselves out of it. So I'll just go through some of those individual arguments before settling on the proposal for what I call an agreement implementation matrix as a framework for judging how to make these multilateral, what I call it is sort of practice-based agreements, practice-based multilateral agreements. The first point is that to do or not to do, that is the only question. It is no longer about what we should do, because broadly speaking, we know what we should do. We can disagree. In terms of global migration, we can disagree as to what we should do, but we know the main arguments. So we are at the stage now whether you do it or you don't do it. And all of the efforts, all of the actions should be focused on that. The people who negotiate policy, unfortunately, are broadly speaking not practitioners. What really gives them kicks, what really excites them, and you see it in the forums, is the beauty of constructive ambiguity and the use of language that means nothing to anybody. You see the excitement and the joy. It's just like some of the UK upper classes and their want of the beau mot. Foreign Secretary Johnson would insult everybody. He would be forgiven if the script was just so eloquent and just so neat because it was a bon mot. This is what excites the policymakers, be it in Geneva or in New York. In fact, they call it constructive ambiguity. I have a friend who once told me that she caught herself talking to her seven-year-old daughter in absolute garbage because she's so used to constructing statements that means nothing that she caught herself and said, "My God, I need to take a leave of absence in order to make sense to my family." Now, one, therefore, in my argument, must inject in those negotiations amongst the negotiators some practitioners. And that does not necessarily mean, sometimes this is defined as bring the grassroots people. But guess what? Some of the grassroots people are also policy activists, not necessarily practitioners. And they also get their kicks on this, and they get their kicks on how they undermine, how they surprise these brilliant minds who preside over them. They belong to the same classical group, in my view, of policymakers. The practitioners are people who we all look down upon. That is, the people who are able to tie their own laces and make things happen. The most skilled practitioners, in my view, are not found in these policymakers. They work for the hospitality trade. They work in hotels and in bars and in supermarkets. Think about it. The supermarket has an aim to sell to you cornflakes every morning, whether there's rain, whether there's snow, whether there's hell, whether there's fire. Broadly speaking, they succeed. If work on eliminating diseases or in healthcare or in education in poor countries was as efficient as supermarkets are efficient in flogging dodgy products to us, the world would be a much better place. But because the skills that goes into that vulgar business of selling, of making people happy in the hospitality, us policymakers, we look down upon them, that this really is not for us. Yet in my view, there need to be some disruption, as the IT people say. You need some disruption in this field by getting the practitioner in the most vulgar areas to come in. Because guess what? They are effective in what they do. So in that area of doing, that we need to focus on doing, you have to get doers in, because the policymakers, generally speaking, are not the doers. Someone out to undermine the United Nations could not have come up with a better way to do it than by imposing some of the rules we have created ourselves. I even sometimes ask myself whether there was a conspiracy to make our rules exactly what they need to be for us not to be effective. Our shared objective in this 21st century UN should focus more on people and less on processes, more on delivery and less on bureaucracy. This is not me being cynical. This is the Secretary General of the United Nations, the new Secretary General. This is what he thinks was happening with the UN and the Center for Multilateralism. So I'm hoping that gives a bit of room in terms of the reform process he would champion, that we would get to the heart of it. But of course, there are very many powerful sort of forces against him. That is the very institution of policymaking in the UN. The second point I want to make is multilateralism is about so-called indivisibility, that everyone must come together and we go. My sense is we need to question this honestly. So I think we should be moving from the so-called coalition of the willing, which is what multilateralism is, to what I call the hyperactivity of the devoted. That is, it's not enough to be willing, but those who are devoted and doing, let them be hyperactive in doing, in the hope that that would be more eloquent in convincing those who are not willing. Because if all of us are willing and we are in this coalition of the willing, that is fine. We are here, we're willing. So what if we don't do? And multilateralism as it is now, is it genuinely the coalition of the willing? In many cases, it is not. Take the current negotiations we have on the Global Compact. I was acting as overarching expert for the GCM. It sounds very painful. It is indeed. Overarching expert of the GCM. And we went to Mexico, Puerto Vallarta in Mexico in December. This was to do the stock taking before that, at the end of consultations, before the formal negotiations start. And on the day we arrived, that's when we heard that the United States have withdrawn from the negotiations. Of course, the United States was not part of the Kyoto Protocol. It was not part of the International Criminal Court. These are big multilateral frameworks. And it indeed withdrew from other international multilateral frameworks, like the one on anti-personnel mines and on anti-ballistic mines. And you have many orders where some of the major players are not playing, so you have to question, is everybody on? And it is right that we take the bigger countries seriously, because they come with a waiting. They don't just come with a single vote, they come with a waiting, because there is a disproportionality in terms of the power and the impact they have, either in acting or in omitting to act. So if you have those big players not part of the deal, the space they leave is bigger than the single seat that they vacate. So in that sense, you have to question how multilateral are these multilateral agreements, which brings to some credit to Peter Sutherland's argument of mini multilateralism. So if then you get the countries that are focused on doing the right thing, and this is where you also have to consider borrowing techniques from a world outside of policy, from the world outside of the public sector, into the world of business, the world of civil society. In the world of business, you know that the product that does well will invite competition and refinement. So what the very instruments for progress is not in the design, is not in the great idea, it is in the greatness, perceived or real, of the product itself. So it's about practice-based. So in this case, whereas in multilateral decisions, it is how many countries have signed. So the pride you hear is this agreement, 170 of the 200 sovereign states of the world have signed. That's what's accounting. No one is counting the extent to which the countries are implemented. In business, your success is not based on how many products you have. It is based on how well your products are being sold. I was going to say unused, but unused is unnecessary in the case of commerce. Because I sell it, whether you don't use it or not, that's your problem, as long as I'm taking your money. Yeah? But it's about that active part rather than the design part. This is so true that even you cannot patent an idea. People get it wrong. They think you can patent an idea. You patent a product because it has to move from just being an idea. Some of the greatest ideas in the world, in my view, is the very idea of selection, origin of species by natural selection. This is so profound, Charles Darwin. And guess what? When he was thinking about it, a Welshman in the other part of the world around Indonesia was thinking about the same idea. So it's not about ideas, it's about the products and the activity. Then you move from 170 countries agreeing it. But what happens through that agreement? Usually, you wouldn't be surprised to know that it is about compromises, constructive ambiguity, and the use of versatile words that are subject to various interpretations, to the extent that you end up with usually the lowest common denominator. So you are watering down to make it usable for everyone. But many countries do sign these agreements even if they don't agree. They sign it not because they agree, but number one, maybe many other countries have agreed already, so they go with the flow. There's others who sign it, and there are some African countries, I won't name them, who are known for signing any agreement you give them. So they have a superb reputation as being signers of the best agreements in the world. Because their view is very simple. Let's just give them a signature. They sign in Geneva and in New York, and they wouldn't even remember what they've signed because it's irrelevant to them. There are also that sign because the bully boys tell them to. There are also those who sign because the bribers tell them to. So there are many reasons why countries sign multilateral agreements beyond the fact that they agree or not. Then amongst those who agree, so let's then discount all of these guys, the 170 countries that sign. Let's be generous and just say 10%, 15 or 20 are really signing for other reasons. Let's just assume the whole 150 agree wholeheartedly and have a full understanding of all of the details of it and agree to it. Then what happens? A relatively small percentage would ratify it at home, That ratification process usually takes several years. That straight away cuts the number from 150 to around 75 or lower. And some of the most progressive agreements, it's less than 50% over a period of 10 years. Then you are with the 75%, 5 years, 10 years is gone. Some have signed it, and they haven't implemented it. And I tend to say that the reason why countries sign documents, agreements, and do nothing about it is because they are a bit like me. They cannot blush. So they have no shame. They have no shame, and nobody can see their shame. So you can sign and do nothing about it, and nothing comes to it because nobody sees your shame. It carries no shame. In the bits that it carries shame, very, very irregularly, you dare not point it because you are in the midst of some order bargaining that you don't want to point a finger to a particular country. And in most cases, there is no penalty. So you've gone through this whole process of getting policymakers not practicing to negotiate and develop lowest common denominator agreements, which has taken a long time to domesticate, and it's signed, and you have the pleasure of ignoring it. And that is our broad framework. I don't think it's good enough. I think we should approach these agreements by looking at the likelihood of a country implementing it rather than a country agreeing. And if you go with that, it will invariably mean that not all countries will sign. And I'm okay with that. I'm okay with a framework if not all countries would sign, but those who sign will implement. Because in reality, perhaps you will get more implementation than even you had more people to sign. And remember, you also have the power of the crowds. And if most people who say they've signed and belong to the club are non-deliverers, don't be surprised if non-delivery takes hold and becomes the culture within that club. And in the practice-based approach, you would just face reality, be honest, and cut out the crap, as it were. Why are we not doing it? Because the powers or the negotiators who are vested in doing it, I think there is a fear that it would be them who would be out of business, because it's about policy making, not policy implementing. But there is enough concern. This analysis I make and this diagnosis I make, I don't think I'm the first person to have done it, and I think many people understand and recognize it. And you've heard the statement of the Secretary General of the United Nations. And he is a UN person. For 8 years or so, he ran UNHCR. Before that, he ran Portugal. Now, if he is, say, having this concern, if he have a critical mass of people around him, maybe there is some chance to deal with the much needed reform that everyone talks about. In the business of implementing, you are also talking about operations, about things working on a daily basis and a minute level. As I said earlier, this is considered rather low level and vulgar by the policymakers because it's not strategy, it's not a big picture. My problem is I've got enough big picture. I've got enough big picture. The problem, no country is suffering because of lack of a good policy. We suffer for want of good implementation. So we need to be focused on that. I took the trouble, since I was in the privileged position to be acting on behalf of the co-facilitators of this negotiations process, to propose a template a template of how do you then set out creating a practice-based multilateral agreement. Of course, now the good thing is most of these agreements, they try to limit it to less than 50 pages. But 50 pages is still a lot of pages. Now with this global compact, there's an attempt, the co-facilitators are keen to make it 30 pages or fewer. And I think they would succeed. I have told them, and I've given them an offer, which they have chosen to return to me. But I have given them an offer that I can do this for them for 10 pages and give them a little bit of change in that on page 10, I won't use all of the A4, that it is possible. But they have kindly asked me to go away with my offer. And I suggest you have a simple paragraph, a preamble of 2-3 lines, at most 5 lines, in which don't renew any big principles. Just make reference to all relevant agreements that have happened before. You save yourself 3-4 pages of unnecessary. By the way, if you are bored enough, if you have problem with insomnia, I suggest you choose one of these documents for your nightly reading, and you will see what I'm talking about. The level of repetition, it's not that I don't believe in repetition as a form of reinforcement, but boy, these guys have taken it to an entirely new level, and that is norm. You sit there, it's being discussed, you think, gosh, can they hear themselves? And the answer is yes, and they like it. Yeah. And they would repeat all of this stuff that have gone on and on and on. And I'm saying, but we know it. Just give me a single line that make reference to everything, and it's over. I offered to do that for them as a preamble. They wouldn't accept it. Then you set out a single vision. In this case on migration and development, the vision, we already have it. It is something along the lines that migration should be a choice, not a desperate necessity. Something along those lines. Nobody disagrees with it. It's a big idea. We know what it means, and we can see practical illustrations of that. Countries that, generally, the countries that have problems with visas are poor countries. As soon as they become rich, they don't have problem with visa, so mobility and migration for them is not a problem. 15, 20 years ago, if you are the official list of countries in the world that are more prone and have a high risk of people being trafficked was China. In fact, some of you will remember in the United Kingdom, laws had to be changed because a whole number of Chinese people died in a container. They were being smuggled into the UK. Today, you go to United States, there are some university campuses where 60% or more of the student population are Chinese. Even the United Kingdom, which is not part of Schengen, its visa rules are very difficult, have modified its visa rules for what? To make it easy for Chinese people to come to the UK. What's changed? They've become richer. Yeah? So I tend to say that I don't know any country in the world. That's not true. I know 2 or 3. But I exaggerate to make the point. I don't know any country in the world that is against migration. Most countries that claim to be against migration are generally against poor migrants. Take, for example, the United Kingdom. People may say it's against migration. I can tell you, almost all of these countries, I can tell you how much it would cost to actually buy a passport from that country. I'm not talking about you just coming in, but to buy a passport of that country. Because almost every country has a system of external investment which would allow you resident status leading to citizenship. And this includes some of the countries that actually are shameless in saying that I'm anti-migrant. Yeah? So what they are against is poor migrants or migrants of different color or migrants of different religion. But it is not that are against migrants. So you set a big vision, then you reaffirm existing agreements, you don't have to list them. This agreement would list every agreement beforehand, yes? It's like a genealogy, us listing our ancestors and how much respect we have for them. It's not necessary. Just acknowledge everything that have existed before. Then you can genuinely, if there's genuinely a new principle you want to bring in, then that we can discuss. And on the discussion on migration and development, for me, I don't think there are many big, genuine principles to bring in. There are one or two which have been suggested. I'm pushing for one, and they're debating it now in New York. For example, I think there should be a principle on regularization. That is, if you are an irregular migrant in any country, if you are a child after 7 years, irrespective of how you came to be there or how you came to be irregular, you need to be regularized, that is, have the right to stay. And if you are an adult, the countries of the world can have a debate as to how many years, 7 years, 10 years, 15 years, whatever. But there should be a principle that if you are irregular in a country as an adult, after a certain number of years, you need to be regularized. That's a genuine principle that the countries can discuss. You can agree on the principle and discuss the details and the particularities. Then I suggested they have a section in these new practice-based multilateral agreements on what I call commit to omit. In many of these agreements, the problem we have is not what we do, but the things that we fail to do. Yeah? So we need to pick out certain things also that we must never do. So in migration and development, you would be talking about detention of children. You must never detain children, full stop. So commit to that. And I suggest you have a chapter and a heading for it, because it won't be long, but it's clear. This is the red zone. This is the one thou shalt not. And you can have that detention of children and few other points. And you can then focus on your actionable commitments, as it were. That's the language already in the Global Compact. So you can list and say, these are the commitments we have, but they're actionable. This is what I do relating to them. And the final point I suggest is, usually on these agreements, there's a review mechanism. I think it should be review, monitoring, and improvement. Right now in the negotiations, some countries are objecting to the word of monitoring. I'm happy to forego that. But I want, and they haven't agreed it yet, the word improvement to be there. So you can have review and improving. Because the whole point about wanting to rebuild or monitor, for me, is not to name and shame, is to improve. And if you have that sort of openness, that this whole practice is a very difficult affair, there's no country that is perfect in how it implements, but there are many countries that do well in one area and do not do very well in some other area. Then if you have improvement as the motive, it becomes relatively easy to do that. I'm looking at the time. We've got about 45 minutes. So maybe I will just make one more observation and pause for question and answers. And for that, what I would say is, I suggested that they should have a section on means of implementation. These negotiations is co-facilitated by two member states, the permanent representative of Switzerland to the UN, the permanent representative of Mexico. At the very early days, when they were first appointed, and there's all of these meetings you have, and I said we must have a section on means of implementation, we must have an estimate of the money involved, and we must state it if we have any seriousness. And both of them told me, if you don't want to wreck these discussions, just keep talking about money. He said, we should not talk about it. It should not be there. I knew they were wrong, but I dared not tell them, because you cannot have a serious discussion without talking about the money. So now there is talk of the means of implementation, but it won't go as far as it should. For example, we propose that we have to have a migration and development facility. That's a mechanism that's well known within the UN and other systems. That is, this is a pot of money that we will use to implement this agreement. And then you open it up and countries would contribute to it. You make an estimate. Right now, I don't think it would go that far, but there's discussion about an implementation process. And I'm hoping that it's slightly more detailed to it. So in summary, it is not impossible. In fact, it's not even complicated to devise a practice-based multilateral agreement. Unfortunately, the history, the culture, and those who make this are not in the business of practice. They're in the business of policy, and there need to be some coup d'etat. Thank you.
Well, I think you now realize why Jibril is such a sought-after speaker in this forum, because I think you do bring a very unique and fresh perspective on this. Now it's time for questions and answers, so you are posing the questions and Jibril will answer. So who is first? So can you please introduce yourself and try to stick to questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that presentation. It was really interesting, really refreshing, as he mentioned. My name is Irene. I'm an alum of the LSE, actually. And I'm currently working in something very related to what you've been speaking about. So I'd like to speak with you later, if that's possible. I have many questions, but I will pick only two. So first, do you think that for these agreements to be more actionable or to make sure that people who sign them actually are willing, seriously willing to implement them, a clause including acceptance of the jurisdiction of the international court or some kind of international court would be helpful? Mm-hmm. And second, you mentioned some business practices. Do you think that business can make a positive contribution, specifically relating to asylum and migration? And thank you very much.
Okay. So I'll collect a few questions, so maybe three if we have. Who else? In the back there.
Thank you, Boat. Just quite interesting presentation, Professor. I was interested in the
aspect. Can you introduce yourself?
Yes, sorry. My name is Seth Jam. I'm not a student here,
no.
But I'm a businessman.
Yeah.
Yes. So in
it's okay.
Renewable. So it's okay. Yeah. All right. So I was interested I've got two questions. One in terms of the weighted number in these countries that has the biggest vote. Because where I come from, I see ourselves as ones without the weight.
Mm-hmm.
And our subordinate actually applies on us in terms of the principles or the strategies that have been driven for us to deliver. So my two questions are the mini lateral structures of strategies that countries can engage into. Mm-hmm. Do you always think it favors the bigger ones than the smaller ones?
Mm-hmm.
In both in trade, in policies, in exchange of goods, mm-hmm. and also in migration as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other bit is, the case here has been always, you know, we're always looking for doers, mm-hmm. but do you think in terms of gap of wealth and education between the strategies and the people that are employing those strategies and the doers is so vast that they will never understand the people below what they feel?
Mm-hmm.
And they will never be able to deliver to them.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
Mm-hmm.
There. Sorry.
Thank you. Thanks, Jibril. So my name is Stella Opoku-Owusu. I work with Afford UK.
Okay.
I had a specific question for Jibril when you were talking about the sort of culture, if you like, of the countries and the fact that a lot of them have tended, obviously, to agree for one reason or the other, but the implementation is another story altogether. And also the number of years it takes for the ratification and all of that. So just wanted to hear from you what you think, or your idea of what success rate, if you like, would be in terms of the ideas that you have and the implementation strategies that you have, just to get a sense of what you would see, I suppose, as a success, as a success rate.
Okay, should I take those? In terms of whether one would be more effective if you have countries to accept jurisdiction of international courts, I don't think that would make it more effective, because straight away it makes it about disputation, and it brings in some of our other friends who are not always helpful in this matter, that is lawyers. Yeah? And it would all be about disputation. It's even focused more about the work. What tends to happen now is to have reporting systems whereby it's not only the official report of the country, but you have peer reports, peer reviews, and you also have shadow reports by non-governmental organizations. And I think more transparency in that sense would be more useful than a legalistic dispute-based form of evidencing. In terms of business, their role in this sector, especially in asylum and migration, in all of these discourses, I, for example, am the chair of the Entrepreneurship and Circular Migration Committee of the Global Forum on Migration, the business mechanism, and it is part of my task to help try to bring business in it. Everywhere you go in these forums, business is the missing link, as it were. They don't come in. Why are they so shy? Because when you talk about business and migration, they are involved of every part of it. They're the one who fly us. Even in a crude manner, the traffickers are in business. The people traffickers are in business. But if you take the legitimate business, the people who make money out of migration, they belong to three groups. One is the traffickers, which is illegal. Then you have business in general. Then you have government, because government extract a lot of money from migration in the form of taxation, fees, and all manner of stuff. Take, for example, visa system alone. The Home Office makes a huge profit. Literally, it makes a profit out of visa system. So why is business shy? Business is shy because they don't want to be hit by some of the populist views and anti-migration sentiments that can get hold of a country, and they think it might impinge on their business. But it is not true that they're not involved. They are involved in a hidden manner. And it is part of my job and orders to encourage them to come out a bit more. All of these businesses are constantly involved in lobbying the key decision makers. I was at an event organized by Vaughan here, actually on the day from there I flew to Mexico City, and this question came up about business. And I was advised that in that room we were on the Chatham House rule. And of course, the Chatham House rule, my interpretation is, whatever you say should remain in the room until you check who would leak it first. Yeah? So of course, everyone should reveal a secret. And the one I revealed was, I have it from a good source, that before Angela Merkel made the decision to open the doors of Germany for 1 million people, the last person she spoke with is the chairman of Daimler Benz. It was not the foreign minister or any other migration guru. It was the chairman of Daimler Benz. Because the businesses know the importance of migration. They lobby because they move millions of people on visas, on work visas. So they are very much involved, but they do it as they work everywhere, sort of under the radar. But the impact they have and the credibility they can add to the general advocacy, they need to come out more. Now the way they do it is they send their trade associations. For the UK, they would send CBI. and they would send these trade associations and say, you speak for me. But we need to have more of these business leaders themselves, because some of them tell very powerful stories, because a huge number of them, over 60%, wherever they are migrants or children of migrants. This is a global fact, the leaders of the big businesses, wherever. Because in that business, there's so much fluidity in the big business that talent moves around. And in the United States, studies have shown that in the top 500 countries, I can't remember the percentage, but it was over companies, it was over 50% of the companies were either founded by migrants or the children of migrants. So migration and development and business are closely linked. I always even remind people that the very word venture, which is used in business, is a migration word. Mm-hmm. It is to venture out, is to go out. So the link is very strong. Another element, a core element of business, is taking risk. And going out, being a migrant, historically, from an evolutionary point of view, is amongst the riskiest things you could do. So we need to get business to come out more. In terms of the gap between the rich countries and the poor countries, the gap you mentioned and the assumption that the powerful countries would have more impact is true. But that has been known for a long time, and of course poor countries don't like it. So they have developed mechanisms to deal with this. In fact, some authorities on this would say that multilateralism have historically been championed by the middle countries, because we miss them. You have the big countries, you have the poor countries, but there's a whole lot of middle countries in there. And those middle countries want to have influence as well. You're talking of Canada, you're talking of Switzerland, and a few other countries. They want to have influence. So what's been happening in this framework is alliances are being built. So, for example, developing countries, that's how you have the groups. They set up groupings whereby they would vote together, they would advocate together. In fact, as the negotiations going on now on this compact, the whole of Africa is negotiating as one group. Well, the Africa group, being represented by the distinguished representative of the Republic of Comoros. So everything is going there through her. So when other countries, African countries, are even speaking first, they would align themselves to the statement of Comoros before they add something else. So that's been a mechanism, and it allows them to group together and have, in some cases, perhaps even more power than the bigger countries. And there are also other mechanisms, because the business of voting is not based on policy advocacy alone. I try to differentiate between advocacy and influencing. The difference between advocacy and influencing is the advocacy, you say, these are my points, and you go around and try to convince the other parties to come to your side, or you get a compromise. The best influencing is the points that I have, I put it to you in a manner that you think it's yours. And then you put it across. And I congratulate you for being so brilliant. Yeah? And that is not the gift of just big countries. You can be a small country and be good at that. And there are some small countries that are good at that. And it's a principle that works in general in different domains, not even just in countries. In terms of the gap of the highly educated, well-paid policymakers and sort of grassroots, in fact, in my differentiation, the practitioners can also be highly educated and well-paid, but only that they're in different type of business. I give an example. So you would have the professor of international relations, who I would rudely refer to as a policymaker. And you can have the general manager of the Hilton Hotel. and the general manager of the Hilton Hotel may even be paid more than the professor, but she is a practitioner. She makes sure that the very demanding guests, the things that the very demanding guests want, she would give it to them even before they know that they want it. Yeah? That's a practitioner. And just imagine if this is what we had in development, in health provision, in educational provision. So it's not a disparity in education or income, it's a disparity in type of work. And Stella, the point you make about this implementation success, as it were, I don't know the statistics of what's the success of this country. But for me, the evidence of testing it is, again, coming back to the first answer of having the peer-to-peer reviews and the shadow reports. And these days, it's actually relatively easy, and several attempts have been made. In the case of Migration and Development, IOM, which is now the UN agency on migration, has developed different forms of reporting where best practices can be published. People would put up things. You can have now what the IT people call a dashboard. So you would have a practice and publish it for people to see. That's very important for different reasons, because there's a curious thing that happens in the doing. I mentioned regularization. Most likely, if I ask a question, in the United Kingdom here, do we have a policy to regularize irregular or so-called illegal migrants? Do you know whether we regularize them? No. Yes, yeah, exactly. Yes. She said currently we even expel legal residents. That's the Windrush paper. So the view would be that we don't. Many people would tell you that we don't. But actually we do. We do have a regularization policy. But it is for many years, it has always been a hidden policy, but now it's a very ungenerous and hostile one. It used to be the case that if you are an irregular migrant in the UK, after 14 years, irrespective of how you became irregular, you can declare yourself to the Home Office, and 99% of the case, the Home Office would give you stay. That practice is still there, but you have to wait for 20 years. Now, many people would say that breaks the human rights rules or principles. But there are other countries that regularize in a more open manner, in a more structured manner, but they are very shy. They don't like admitting it. They know it's good for the country, but when they do it, they think they would lose votes for it, so they hide it. So there's been reports where organizations, institutions have done these studies and published it. So if we had a sort of dashboard of good practices, not only would we invite countries to publish, but others, academics and others, would find the information and publish and say, you don't have to be shy about the good things you do. Yeah?
Great.
Hi, my name is Bronwyn Manby. I have various hats here. I'm visiting fellow, research fellow. I would like to speak in favor of words and documents. Because one of the things that one is doing with this type of multilateral document is articulating a vision of a different way that things could be, as well as, so even if an agreement of this type isn't implemented that well, it still serves a purpose as an articulation of a vision. And in that context, I'd like to ask you, what is your way of articulating a vision that makes it more likely to be implemented in the sense that it speaks to the xenophobes, speaks to the people, and I don't, not xenophobe is maybe even too harsh, speaks to the people whose world is disturbed by the hypermobility that one sees of rich people as well as of poor people, and in fact possibly especially of rich people, how community is undermined by mobility. What is your, their perception? What is your vision that you would articulate in this document that would address that concern?
Maybe this is such a crucial point in your arguments. Maybe we can take this specifically. I mean, you started with the Sustainable Development Goals, and
yes.
you know, you could, of course, you could take them as, you know, this is even laws or you know, some these are rules that we have all agreed to.
Mm-hmm.
But you could also take them as aspirations and visions, and you know, world leaders signed up to them.
Yes.
No one has costed them. No one has. You looked at what would it really take mm-hmm. to achieve these things by 2030. Still, we hope that they serve a purpose. How do you, you know, so what is your alternative? And I guess that's your question too. You know, what is it that make you, you know, how should we tie people to aspirations and visions? And
so I wouldn't take away all the beautiful words. But I'll keep it to where you're suggesting. I'll keep it to the vision. And worry about the act. That's why it won't be 30 pages, it will be 10 pages. And I would approach it the way when my business partner is here, we used to do a lot of training on strategy setting. We'll set vision, mission, and all of that. And our own take as to what the vision is. The vision is the dream, which if you achieved it, you closed your business. Yeah? So that means it's definitely aspirational and long-term. And by the time you achieve it, you should close up and go home. Yeah? For, I am suggesting that for many of these things, the vision already exists. And it is in language that is already moving, that does all of the things it wants it to do. If you go to the Sustainable Development Goals, it talks about the six P's, and it talks about leave no one behind. Now, in every language, people have a sense of what it is, that you leave no one behind. However you interpret it, you've got that. In terms of this, I am arguing, without success, that there should be that section that has a vision, and it should be around something, as I said, that migration is a choice, not a desperate necessity, something along those lines. I would be happy to keep it at that. And then the rest of it is about leading to the world. And in terms of the wording, there's a question then, what else can you do in the general wording to motivate almost the neurolinguistics of it all? And I wouldn't know the answer. But again, I would bring another set of professionals who are not welcomed in this area. Those are the creatives. I'll bring the creatives to come in, the creative sector, to have a look at this. Because remember, these are the creatives who succeed every day to sell to me things I do not want for money that I do not have. Every day, they succeed. So they know something. So we can bring them to help us in this area. And you mentioned the word xenophobia. So for example, when at the UN summit during the General Assembly, September 2016, three things were agreed. That there would be a global compact on migration, there would be a global compact for refugees, and there would be another agreement for combating xenophobia. And I always thought that names and wordings are so important. So I've been thinking about not using the word xenophobia and having the opposite of xenophobia. But given my limited creativity, the only one I can came up with, I'm too afraid to popularize. Because I'm thinking xenophobia, why don't we talk about xenophobia is the hate of the outsider. What about xenophilia, the love of the outsider? But you would then get stupid people to think that xenophilia means something else criminal. So I'm not going there. But creatives will be able to come up with wording that would be helpful. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Hi, Jibril.
Mm-hmm.
You're always Tohid Pasha from IOM, International Organization for Migration. Always a pleasure to hear you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going back to, well, one question based on what you're saying to the answer to your last question. Is there a fine line between an aspirational document and one that means something in substance, a practical document?
Mm-hmm.
And this leads on to my a question about, at the beginning you were saying that it's better to be, maybe I, correct me if I'm wrong, but were you hinting that it's better to be out than in for a country mm-hmm. if they don't mean it? Mm-hmm. Better not, you know, better mm-hmm. not to sign it mm-hmm. if you don't mean it. Mm-hmm. Or is it better to join it mm-hmm. and try and at least be part of most of it? Now, you probably know that the U.S. may not be the only country that may not sign the Global Compact. A number of other countries are reconsidering their position on aspects such as child detention.
Mm-hmm.
And they may be left out, they may not sign it as a result. But would you not rather see them in it and sign it and at least try and live up to the spirit of the document?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Over there.
My name's Lyndall Stein, and I'm on the board of the Refugee Council, and my interest is working to get public support for challenging issues. So I'm very pleased to hear you talk about the need to get different language and different ways of communicating to take these messages out to the public. But I was really interested in what you were saying about the whole question of children in detention and having a universal approach to that. I think it's such it's so obvious but so important. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you have any ideas of who's working on it or how we could get people to work on it, because it is a very powerful window in to understanding the broader issues of the importance of having a really powerful compact. So.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Yeah, here.
Thank you. I'm Vaughan Jones, also on the board of the Refugee Council and other things. I understand your argument very well, that it's better for people to be in if they're going to do it and out if they're not going to do it. But migration, by definition, is multilateral. You know, I mean, it has to be it's an issue that involves countries of departure, countries of transit, countries of arrival, and that is, by definition, multilateral. So any solution or any approach to migration has to be, by definition, multilateral. And I'm wondering also what happens to the good countries, you know, the ones that sign in and do it. And then the issue of responsibility sharing that goes within that multilateral reality of global migration. So the situation first facing Angela Merkel, you know, when she made a declaration for the million was, well, everybody else should follow suit and do the same, but they didn't, so she was left sort of high and dry. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't that be the big danger of what you were proposing?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So can I just follow up, because I think you had this, I forgot the exact term you used, of the devoted.
Hyperactivity of the devoted.
The hyperactivity of the devoted, because, you know, that is, I think, what you are questioning. So if we have a system on migration where there are some countries that do everything and you know, are perfect global citizens, because of the nature of migration, it doesn't help, because you need to have almost everyone, not everyone, but you need a lot of countries on board.
To play, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's partly even linked to the first question from Tawhid about should it be, if you don't want to do it, then don't sign. First, on how to approach the aspiration. If you go to different sectors, this problem has been solved. In business, for example, and in some civil society, you have aims and goals that you set at different level. You would have the optimistic, the realistic, and the pessimistic. This is said. Sometimes a specific stretch goals whereby remuneration and other things are linked to it. So it need not be as crude as, oh, I have some sympathy, but I'm not fully in, so I'm being locked out. It need not be as crude as that. But the precious thing I want to protect and suggest that we start is really the serious doers should be known and stand out. And the whole argument would stand or fall on the basis of that. So to the last point you make, if it is true that migration is generally good for a country, then the countries that do it and are hyperactive in their doing it will just reap all of the benefits. And those who don't would suffer for it. And given the mechanics, then influence would change. So it will sort of sort itself out. And in that sense, you see it. Some of the most heavily, sort of heavy migration countries are the Middle Eastern countries who depend entirely on migrant workers. With all of the problems, they are not shut down migration, irrespective of whatever happens. Even in a country like the UK here, if there's a book I always recommend, it's not a book on economics, it's a novel, and it's called The Beggar Strike, written by a Senegalese woman called Aminata Sow Fall, no relation. Although I'm from Gambia and Senegal are the same people. And this is the story whereby set in the 1970s in Senegal, where a president is coming to visit the country, and the mayor goes out to round up, as they were planning to do in Windsor, all of the vagabonds and the homeless people in the street so that the city is gentrified and look nice for the visitor. Now, this man, in his quest for political power, went to his marabout. Marabout is a holy man in West Africa. And his marabout tells him that he have to give out charity, alms, to poor people. And guess what? He cleared out the poor people. And now he came out to give them, and the beggars had gone on strike. They were not accepting alms anymore. If the United Kingdom, if the irregular or so-called illegal migrants went on strike, imagine the catastrophe. In fact, films, creatives have created films in the United States and elsewhere called A Day Without Mexicans, and all of the stuff that won't work. So A Day Without Migrants in the UK, you know the trains, that the tube you came with, it won't move. The bus won't move. This whole building would be filthy. And many, many, many things won't work. So there's a countries want migration, and they would never lock out. That's why I said there are only about three countries that really don't want migration. But the differentiation of the serious who want to do it, and if the theory is right, then they will reap the benefits, which by definition will mean others would copy it. But don't lock out those who are not, who've not made up their mind yet. Bring them in. But the people who I don't want, the countries I don't want, is Hungary, as of today. The countries that are clear, they are saying, at least their leadership, we don't want this because they push us down to the bottom. So in this case, when the United States says we're not coming, I wasn't sorry because they would only have been disruptive given the current situation. That does not mean you rule them out, because despite all of the craziness that we get from the president, still the United States is one of the most favorable migration destination countries in the world. He's having a go to damage that, but as we speak, that is the truth. Then there's a question of the public support. There are many organizations involved. In fact, 2 years ago, we thought we had consensus on this at the New York Declaration, which is explicit. I remember those negotiations when, at the heart of it, the one country that led the attack that there shouldn't be this blanket provision that children must not be detained was the United States. It went on and on, but it was Obama time, and on and on and on, until late hours of the night, we got them to relent and it got in there. But you have country, organizations like Save the Children are active in this, so they're in New York. Right now you have PCOM, you have Terrorism. There are very many organizations well organized across the world. In fact, now they are holding the ground in that that provision exists. It's about defending it from everyone who's attacking it, which is one of the perils of reopening negotiations. Because the things that you thought you had, there's a negotiation, someone will try to take it off you. And sometimes it's even more cynical than that, in that the countries that are opposed to this progressive move would spend a lot of your time attacking what you already have, so that you have no time and effort to put forward your progressive ideas. You are on the defensive. And that's usually, that's what I don't want to do. I don't want to be on the defensive. I want us to move on. And the ones who are serious to move should have the room to move on. And yes, I think I've answered partly the third question about migration being multilateral in nature. Now, that does, as I said, no country would cut down migration because they already have a framework how to manage their own visa systems. And the most popular form of migration that everybody, every country is not ashamed to advertise is tourism. And they won't stop doing it. And all of that would happen. This compact is talking about the global governance of migration as a chapeau over everything rather than the national activities that take place.
Good evening. My name is Ilya Ketchapia. Thank you very much for your speech. I'm currently doing my PhD at the University of Hull in social justice, and my case study is human trafficking. So, of course, migration is a very important issue to me. I wanted to ask you a question, but it's probably like in three parts. First, when you look at some of the things that you mentioned concerning migration, because of this, the disparities between the income brackets from the developing countries and the developed countries, we tend to have a lot of young people trying to leave the continent by a very unsafe means, trying to get to Europe. Now, I think logically, if the countries were to accept what you would suggest, we probably wouldn't have this situation. So I'd like to know, in your perspective, what could be an ideal situation to help maybe develop programs in countries like Africa that would reduce young people from trying to leave by a very dangerous means, and also that would probably reduce the chances of, I'm talking about my area now, of women being trafficked into Europe and being exploited sexually. And then last, other supernatural bodies, the influence they have on some of these policies that you're suggesting, such as the World Trade Organization, the IMF and World Bank, because some of their policies, like structural adjustment policies towards countries, especially in Africa, tend to end up making majority of the population poorer. And as a result, they end up looking to places like Europe for better opportunities. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Maybe I can add one question. So you spoke... I mean, you are very careful with words, and you look for words that capture what you're saying. So the maybe the word migration is not the right word. I mean, it's some people argue that it should be mobility, which sort of captures your basic notion of that it should be a choice and not you should not be forced to do it either. So how do you see that? But also that very important question.
So I'll start with yours. I agree, and many people have been pushing. In fact, AFFORD, I'm a board member of AFFORD. We set up an all-party parliamentary group, and there was a push to use mobility in the world. At the end, it became migration, but in the aim, it has mobility in there. And IOM is also pushing that. I was part of an exercise that did a visioning exercise on sort of the future of migration, but it ended being about the future of mobility, as it were. Until recently, well, UK is not part of it, but Schengen is a no-border zone. Yeah, it's borderless. And I know if you are a little islander, this scares you. But if you are not, it is so enlightened. One time I was traveling, I traveled through maybe 3-4 European countries and get to Brussels same day, and it took me longer to get to the meeting room at the Parliament building in Brussels that it's taken me to cross the borders, because there was nothing. But to get into the building, there were more security at that building than at any border. But it's just so enlightening to be able to move between countries. And think about it. This is Europe, which 50 years before that were killing each other to the tens of millions. And 50 years later, you have mobility. Now nobody thinks about France and Germany killing each other, and they've been eternal enemies beforehand. You move across the border as if it's nothing. So we are taking for granted the enlightened benefits of mobility in that sense. And I think all progressives need to push more about that. I still do use the word migration and migrants more, for the very reason that in some quarters it has a negative and frightening connotation. Because if we can fight it and sort of take out the alleged toxicity that goes with it, then even better. That does not mean that mobility should not be pushed, but migrants and migration as a word, the positive elements to it, we need to reclaim it. It's just as we've reclaimed the Union Jack or from the fascists and racists of the United Kingdom. Going back to the question of the main driver or root causes to irregular migration being to do with income and livelihood, there's no doubt about that. That is the reason. And it is so profound that you find a significant degree of dysfunctionality. So, in fact, I talk about irregular and dysfunctional migration. And I convened a conference on that in 2015 in Valletta, in Malta, on how to deal with irregular and dysfunctional migration. And dysfunctional migration is where the migration is generally bad for all of the parties involved, including the migrant, the family of the migrant, and everyone. But when you analyze it, you come back to the point you're making. I wrote a paper in 2003 when I suggested that having a job in many developing countries was no longer an indicator of wealth or lack of wealth. It was no longer whether you've got a job as an indicator of livelihood. The indicator had become whether you've got a remita in your family or not. Because you can have a job in many developing countries and you are on starvation wages and you are poor. Whereas you can be without a job, but you have remittances in your family, and you are relatively affluent. It then follows that reasonable people would seek to create remittances in their midst rather than workers. So they invest not for people, young people, to get jobs, but to be remittances. And this is the logic why they would do what appears dysfunctional, that is, sell their landed property to send their family on the so-called back way to Europe. There's a logic to it. That is why campaigns that are run saying, think about the dangers of taking the irregular route, is a waste of time. They know it, and they're taking the choice. They're making the choice. Right now, I've been involved in EU-wide discussions about them. The EU and perhaps to an extent IOM have now agreed that that message doesn't work because it lacks credibility. Then people, in my view, are moving to the other extreme and saying, look at all of the possibilities if you stayed in your country. But guess what? In many of those countries, if you stay, you will be poor. So the young people are caught into this most difficult one, and the only way is to work on the middle part to change the poverty dynamics in their countries of origin. And we must not be too gloomy about it, because it's possible. And the exemplar is China. Within 15 years, it's been exemplar. We are number one, people being trafficked, including for sexual exploitation, to the position where they are, that is, conservative countries are opening up their visa system for them. So it is possible to do that. Now, if you go to the multilateral financial institutions and their impact, good or bad, on relieving poverty, it's a mixed story. Many of them have agreed it. But when it comes to migration and development, we are almost all on the same progressive page. The World Bank, IMF, they followed on to the progressive page. And right now, I think countries, in my view, are grown up enough to make the choice. They don't have to take the advice from the World Bank. And if they are, and some countries do not refuse to take it, and they negotiate. The structural adjustment program is 30 years old. It was wrong. It caused problems. But it's gone. We're into another phase. And there are some countries who are making, during that time, who've made some judicious decisions that have allowed them to reduce poverty, thus making it a better choice for their citizens to remain in the country. Or when they travel, they come back rather than leaving for good, as it were. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I think that was another illustration of what I said from the beginning, that you bring a very fresh perspective, and you, like few, can articulate these dynamics in from the perspective of sending countries, and it's incredibly valuable. And I also said that you were a leader on migration, and I think this, being a leader on migration, you have this frustration that. You know, you're pushing. You are very much a hyperactive, devoted person in this space, and of course you feel frustrated that not everyone is following. But I think because you have this unique perspective, because you force us to think about this in different ways, you will get more followers, and we will listen again to your frustrations, and your also very constructive suggestions for how to move forward. So thank you very much, Jibril. It's been a pure pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.